No, I think we're recording. All right. Well, welcome back to week three, round three. Always a lot going on. And, you know, kudos to Robert. He wasn't here, so he listened on the podcast. And, you know, he took the photos and all that.
But did he take the test?
What?
Did he take the test?
That's right. It's 9:30. That's why he came early, actually. He took the test. So he's good. So, you know, I want to kind of tell you, you know, Ken Stein's a scholar. He once told me, my advice when I started speaking was, tell him what you're going to tell him, and tell him what you told him. So, trying to follow that method. So tonight we're doing the War of Independence, which is really a two-part, although it's a bit of a misnomer. Next week we're also going into the early 50s, and stuff that was going on then. Just a quick review. Can anybody give me one sentence or one word that we learned about Ben-Gurion last week?
It's determined.
Determined, absolutely. Incredibly focused. An incredibly focused individual. And remember what I had said, too, he really hated the concept of the diaspora, which was part, you know, they had this phrase called the negation of the diaspora. And that drove, remember I talked about his controversy with Mr. Blaustein in Baltimore, who was negotiating on behalf of American Jewry with Israel in terms of, you know, you say you want our money, then stop telling us all to make Aliyah, because we're not going to do it, and so on, because you're going to challenge our loyalty.
He had some tough relationships with his co-leaders.
Absolutely, and a lot of the generals hated him. We didn't get into that too much. He was a very, very strong leader. You know, few people were that strong. Remember, Ben-Gurion was in positions of power from 1920 to 1963. And he didn't leave the Knesset until 1970. Right? He died in 73. So he spent 50 years in positions of power, ostensibly. 1920 to 1970.
He united the military.
He did unite the military, and we're going to get into that a lot. And it wasn't so easy, both from the military that he helped create, the Haganah, as well as the Irgun and the Lachig. Yigal Yadin and Yigal Alon. Which one was the archaeologist?
Yadin.
And what did he excavate?
Masada.
And some of us talked about that book. Yigal Alon. Anybody remember anything about him?
An autographed copy.
You have a copy of it?
Yeah,
that's very cool.
Started the Palma.
Yeah, he was one of the early commanders. Yitzhak Sadeh was the first overall commander, but he was one of the commanders of one of the divisions, as was a guy named Yitzhak Rabin, who commanded the Harel Brigade. He's also the guy that walked into Ben-Gurion a couple days before independence was declared and basically said, we have a 50-50 chance of surviving. And he wanted Ben-Gurion to put off independence for a while. As did a number of people. What?
He also had the best plan for what might be done with the West Bank.
Right, we talked about the Alon plan a little bit and how that drives some conversation today. We talked about Machon Ayalon and the making of weapons, because really the Jews could not bring in weapons because the British still controlled the area. And then we really talked about the civil war between the Palestinian Arabs and the Arab irregulars coming from other states under the eyes of the British. And the British really didn't do that much to stop it. Were there any questions left over from last week? All right, tonight we're going to cover the siege of Jerusalem, which is part of that civil war. Independence is declared. Machal. Machal is mitnavei chutz la'aretz, volunteers from outside of Israel. Some very famous people. Vidal Sassoon. That should have an extra O there. And Mickey Marcus, Colonel David Mickey Marcus. There were three phases of the war. We're going to talk about the Altalena, which we mentioned with Jabotinsky. And again, I think I told you guys, and David, I don't know if you remember this. Altalena is a word in Italian, but I can't remember what it is. Do you have any idea?
Who's the book by Jabotinsky?
Well, it's his pen name. That was his pen name as a journalist in the early 10s and 20s. Do you remember what it is in Italian? It's in the book we read last year, actually.
Yeah, I'll check.
Okay.
The short answer is I don't.
All right, we're going to talk about Kibbutz Yad Mordechai, which was a famous battle. Latrun, which some of you have heard of in the past. Anyone ever been to Latrun? Right, it's the famous museum now, and it's across from the monastery that sells great wine. Palestinian and Jewish refugee crises, and the major results of the war. So that's what we're going to get into tonight. All right, let's see how my handy-dandy slides work tonight. I have so much fun creating them. The first thing I want to talk about is the siege of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a different case. Jerusalem, if you remember, wasn't going to be Jewish or Arab. it was going to be United Nations. There was, for lack of better terminology, a circle around Jerusalem. Now, the UN never got very far in terms of delineating what its powers were going to be, but it was going to rule Jerusalem because the populations lived so close, and it was an interest to the whole world. Some people would like to return to that, actually, in some plans, and some wouldn't. Jerusalem was also under siege, particularly from the Arab Legion. Remember King Abdullah? Yeah?
Swing.
Swing, yeah, and I don't know why he chose that. But that's Altalina. And he wrote in a number of Russian newspapers, and then only after the... We're talking about Jabotinsky, then only... And I'm bouncing around, I apologize. Then after the Kishinev pogroms in 1903, his Zionist Jewish interests were aroused. But he was initially secular, and then he became a great nationalist. And we also talked about the fact that he became somewhat of a fascist, admiring Mussolini, and certainly Ben-Gurion referred to him as a fascist, if not worse. And in the 30s, the word Nazi was tossed around pretty liberally, as it was in the Knesset in the 50s, which we'll see, in reparations. So anyway, back to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was surrounded. We talked last week about King Abdullah's forces. And what did King Abdullah's forces want? Does anybody remember? They wanted Jerusalem and the West Bank. The West Bank. They had an agreement. Remember, Meir goes back and forth meeting with King Abdullah, and they basically had an agreement that said, we're not going to go into other areas. We won't challenge you if you don't challenge us. Latrun was on the West Bank at that point, so they held Latrun, which was an old British fortress. It's called a Taggart fortress. There are Taggart fortresses built in the 20s and 30s all over Israel because they were British police stations, and they were built in a certain style, and they were almost always on strategic hilltops, so there were always battles over Taggart fortresses. It's a Taggart. There are attempts by the Jews to bring relief into Jerusalem. We talked about the convoys you see on the left-hand side of the road as you're going up. This is one of those convoys. And look at this. It's awaiting UN inspection before departure. Well, it's awaiting UN inspection because the UN doesn't want them to be smuggling in any weapons. And certainly they tried, and certainly the Arabs were bringing in weapons. And it was much easier for the Arabs because they could bring them in over borders, right? And the borders were not particularly secure. The Jews couldn't bring anything in because they had to bring them in by sea, and by air was basically impossible. Marshall, did you have a question?
No.
Okay, I thought you were motioning for that. The most famous one takes place one day before independence. 1948, a large convoy is going up to Hadassah Hospital. We know Hadassah Hospital is not far from the Hebrew University. So they are ambushed, and I have 77 doctors, nurses, scientists, and technicians are slaughtered. And this is a very, very tragic thing. Of course, the hospital isn't opened again until after the 67 war. The Hebrew University campus, the northern campus, isn't opened again until after the war. Even though the Israelis controlled it, it was just too dangerous to get to. They basically controlled the road going up to there. About 100,000 Jews were isolated in West Jerusalem. A lot of these were religious Jews. This included, by the way, some in the Old City, a couple thousand maybe. They were scholars at the Hebrew University. They were city people, and they didn't know how to deal with this. There was a tremendous amount of rationing taking place. There's a lot of stories about this. But one of the things that it did, interestingly enough, is it enhanced and increased and improved discipline amongst the Jewish population. This would be a key factor during the war and in the years after. And this is one of the things that even in the decades before had always helped the Jewish community. They had discipline. They listened to their leadership for the most part. We've talked about the Stern Gang and the Lehi. Mayor Dov Yosef instructed people to pick what are called mallow leaves and to boil them. That's how they got their food. They weren't getting much nutrition at all. The Haganah was using what they called sandwich trucks. They jimmied steel along these trucks. I think I have a photo of one of them coming up. The siege wasn't broken until June 14th. Something called the Burma Road, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, comes into being. Here's another picture. One of the many pictures I love. This guy is the provost of Hebrew University. Just like everybody else, he's getting his water. He's getting his rations of water. these aren't necessarily pictures that we associate with Israel today by any stretch of the imagination. It was a very difficult time, but some of these people had come out of concentration camps. Some of them had been in the country for 20 or 30 years. They knew what it meant to not have things, so they were disciplined. Doesn't mean it was easy, but they knew that they could handle it. Despite all those problems, independence is declared on May 14, 1948. Now, the funny thing is, it was to be a secret. No one was supposed to know about this. Well, everybody knew about it. Crowds gathered outside of Independence Hall in Tel Aviv. Anyone ever been in there? What was your first thought when you went in there?
Teeny.
I had a distinct one. What?
Teeny.
Exactly. It's so small. This is where this big idea came into being. Well, Ben-Gurion declares on May 14, 1948, that at midnight, the Jewish state of Israel is going to be declared. The United States, which is prepared to recognize it, has to write in Israel in the document, because nobody knows what the name of the state is going to be. Is it going to be Judea?
Zion.
Is it going to be Zion? You know, is it going to be, you know, Shlomo? I mean, who knows what it's going to be? So there was a lot of uncertainty going on. And I was telling Rabbi Starr before this class began that if we do anything in this class, if we make time for anything, it's to hear the Declaration of Independence. So let's see how we're doing on volume, and I want to listen to this. We might not do the whole 12 minutes. Let's see how it goes. David Ben-Gurion.
אשר אושרה בקריאה ראשונה על ידי מועצת העם. בארץ ישראל קם העם היהודי, בא עוצבה דמותו הרוחנית, הדתית והמדינית, בא חי חיי קוממיות ממלכתית, בא יצר נכסי תרבות לאומיים וכלל אנושיים, והוריש לעולם כולו את ספר הספרים הנצחי. לאחר שוב לה העם לארצו בכוח הזרוע, שמר לה אמונים בכל ארצות פזוריו, ולא חדל מתפילה ומתקווה לשוב לארצו ולחדש בתוכה את חירותו המדינית. מתוך קשר היסטורי ומסורתי זה חתרו היהודים בכל דור לשוב ולהיחס למולדתם העתיקה, ובדורות האחרונים שבו לארצם בהמונים, וחלוצים, מעפילים ומגינים הפריחו נשמות, החיו שפתם העברית, בנו כפרים וערים, והקימו יישוב גדל והולך, השליט על משקו ותרבותו, שוחר שלום ומגן על עצמו, מביא ברכת הקדמה בכל תושבי הארץ, ונושא נפשו לעצמאות ממלכתית. בשנת תרנ"ז 1897 נתכנס הקונגרס הציוני לכל קריאתו של הוגה חזון המדינה היהודית תיאודור הרצל, והכריז על זכות העם היהודי לתקומה לאומית בארצו. זכות זו הוכרה בהצהרת בלפור ביום ב' בנובמבר 1917 ואושרה במנדט מטעם חבר הלאומים, אשר נתן במיוחד תוקף בינלאומי לקשר ההיסטורי שבין העם היהודי לבין ארץ ישראל ולזכות העם היהודי להקים מחדש את ביתו הלאומי. השואה שנתחוללה על עם ישראל בזמן האחרון, בה הוכרעו לטבח מיליונים יהודים באירופה, הוכיחה מחדש בעליל את ההכרח בפתרון בעיית העם היהודי מחוסר המולדת ועצמאות על ידי חידוש המדינה היהודית בארץ ישראל, אשר תפתח לרווחה את שערי המולדת לכל יהודי ותעניק לעם היהודי מעמד של אומה שוות זכויות בתוך משפחת העמים. שארית הפליטה שניצלה מהטבח הנאצי היום באירופה ויהודי ארצות אחרות לא חדלו להציל לארץ ישראל על אף כל קשי ומניעה וסכנה, ולא פסקו לתבוע את זכותן לחיי כבוד, חירות ועמל ישרים במולדת עמם. במלחמת העולם השנייה תרם היישוב העברי בארץ את מלוא חלקו למאבק האומות השוחרות חירות ושלום נגד כוחות הרשע הנאצי, ובדם חייליו ובמאמצו המלחמתי קנה לו את הזכות להימנות עם העמים מייסדי ברית האומות המיוחדות. 29 בנובמבר 1947 קיבלה עצרת האומות המיוחדות החלטה המחייבת הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל. העצרת קבעה מאת תושבי ארץ ישראל לאחוז בעצמם בכל הצעדים הנדרשים מצדם הם לביצוע ההחלטה. הכרה זו של האומות המאוחדות בזכות העם היהודי להקים את מדינתו אינה ניתנת להפקעה. זוהי זכותו הטבעית של העם היהודי להיות ככל עם ועם עומד ברשות עצמו במדינתו הריבונית. לפיכך התכנסנו, אנו חברי מועצת העם, נציגי היישוב העברי והתנועה הציונית, ביום סיום המנדט הבריטי על ארץ ישראל. ותוקף זכותנו הטבעית וההיסטורית, ועל יסוד החלטת עצרת האומות המאוחדות, אנו מכריזים בזאת על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל, היא מדינת ישראל.
First public declaration of the name of the state. Big secret.
של המדינה היהודית אשר תקרא בשם Israel. Midinat Israel. Tehri Ptucha. Lalia Yehudit Ulkibut Galiot. Tishkot Al Pituacha Aret Letovat Kol Toshera. Tehri Mushkedet Al Yisodot Achirut Hatzedek Vashalom Leor Chazonam של נביאי ישראל. תקיים שוויון זכויות חברתי ומדיני גמור לכל אזרחיה בלי הבדל דת וגזע ומין.
An Arab Knesset member.
תבטיח חופש דת, מצפון, חינוך, תרבות ולשון. תשמור על המקומות הקדושים של כל הדתות ותהיה נאמנה לעקרונותיה של מגילת האומות המיוחדות. מדינת ישראל תהיה מוכנה לשתף פעולה עם המוסדות והנציגים של האומות המיוחדות להגשמת תכליתה העצרת יום 29 בנובמבר 1927, והיא תפעל להקמת האחדות הכלכלית של ארץ ישראל בשלמותה. אנו קוראים לאומות המוחדות לתת יד לעם היהודי כבניין
מדינתו
ולקבל את מדינת ישראל לתוך משפחת הלב. אנו קוראים גם בתוך התקפת הגנים הנערכת עלינו לחדשים לבני העם הערבי תושבי מדינת ישראל לשמור על השלום וליטול חלקם כבניין המדינה על יסוד אזרחות מלאה ושווה ועל יסוד נציגות מתאימה.
I don't know why it's here. It's election results from the recent election.
לתרום חלקה במאמץ משותף לקדמת המזרח התיכון כולו. אנו קוראים אל העם היהודי בכל התפוצות להתלכד סביב היישוב בעלייה ובבניין ולעמוד לימינו במערכה הגדולה על הגשמת שאיפת הדורות לגאולת ישראל. מתוך ביטחון בצור ישראל הננו חותמים בחתימת ידינו לעדות על הכרזה זו במושב מועצת המדינה הזמנית על אדמת המולדת עיר תל אביב, היום הזה ערב שבת אייר תש"ח 14 במאי 1948. לקבל את מגילת היסוד למדינת היהודים בעידה. ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם שהחיינו וקיימנו והגיענו לזמן הזה.
That's a rabbi whose name I've forgotten. I don't know if you remember David. He signed the Declaration of Independence. He was one of the early religious Zionists, and Ben-Gurion respected him.
Is there any one person given credit for primary authorship of the...
That's a great question. Not that I know of is the answer. I don't know if... Not that I know of is the answer. Like, we know Jefferson, obviously, was the Declaration of Independence here. Not that I know of, but I'm going to try and find out. Yeah.
On the domestic side, one thing Ben-Gurion promised that he didn't deliver was a constitution.
Right. Well, yes and no. Well, Ben-Gurion didn't deliver it, but Israel today is ruled by what's called basic laws, and legally the basic laws are considered a constitution. there's periodic talks about it, particularly by the Israel Democracy Institute, to merge them into one document. The Supreme Court sees those documents as a constitution. And there's a basic law in the army, and a basic law in the government, and a basic law on, you know, rights, civil rights, and stuff like that. But in the American sense, you are absolutely correct. So, just like we did the first week, I'm going to go around the room, what we call a quick whip. One sentence or one word, and what that made you think of. You can pass. You can pass.
I like the credibility factor that he established, you know, the case, you know, for everything that, from day one through that time.
Yeah, that's the whole course right there.
Yeah, I mean, it was really setting the credibility case for the state.
Excellent. It's fine.
Realization of Herzl's vision.
Realization, political realization of Herzl's vision combined with the practical vision of people like Ben-Gurion.
Well, it breaks my heart to hear them talk about their heartfelt belief that this was going to be a country where there would be freedoms and civil rights for all, and that is certainly not the country that we're looking at today.
Well, and in fact, the Arabs in Israel were under military rule until 1966. We're going to have a whole unit on the Arabs. There's a lot of difficult things to talk about. And some would say there are reasons, and some would say there are no reasons. So the debate goes on. Yes?
I think the feeling was to grasp the moment and depend on themselves, not on anybody else.
Yes.
Okay.
So first, it made me proud. Number two is, I like the history portion that he put out. But then what I found interesting was, I mean, he didn't put those pictures together, of course, but they show the Arabs with bullets over their shoulders and guns. That's how they portray the Arabs in this
moment. Right. And to be fair, there were certainly many Jews with bullets over their shoulders at that very moment.
Culmination of the first big step.
I'm going to slip to the back and then come back to Mitch.
I just think the whole thing is amazing.
As remember, one of the things we said in the first session, were you here the first session? I can't remember. Okay. That's right, Henry wasn't here the first session, right?
I wasn't here the second session.
I get it all mixed up. Well, something like that. One of the things we did say the first session was Zionism is considered by many to be the most successful national movement of the 20th century. You know, regardless of how you feel about it. Yeah.
What comes to mind is 66 years later, we're still fighting for that state, and there's no assurance that things will get any better anytime soon.
Yeah. And yet, we don't forget the accomplishments that we've made, but you're absolutely correct. As a people, I should say, when I say we.
I mean, I'm glad to see that Ben-Gurion reaching out to other people. I know, you know, to justice and all the things that a democracy stands for. I know it hasn't been achieved, but, I mean, he's the one that said that there's no solution to the Arab situation.
Right, we looked at that last week, right.
But he's at least, you know, reaching out and trying to make it part, you know, trying to have a solution to it.
Yeah, he's laying out ideals, visions, which you should do at the beginning of a great enterprise.
What he's talking about is we deserve to be just like every other country. We paid our dues, as it were, and we just want to join the family of nations on an equal footing.
Right, you know that famous saying, when the prostitutes are Jewish, when the policemen are Jewish, you know, then we'll have a normal country. I don't think there could ever be a normal Jewish country, and I'm totally okay with that.
No, I was thinking how his pie in the sky inclusion, and then when I saw the refugees coming from the concentration camps, coming off the boat, it was like, we finally have a place.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. Shall you want to add anything?
I just really liked that they ended it with Shehecheyanu. I just found that really very fitting.
Frischman. It was Rabbi Frischman. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, just a blessing on something new. I thought it was very fitting.
Absolutely. You guys in the back, want to add anything? No? So, I think we would all agree that we've come so far, and this is it, this is the moment, and from now on in the course, we're going to see how difficult it has been to live up to those values. But first, we have to get through the War of Independence. Because as Yigael Alon said, 50-50 chance for independence. So when we see refugees coming into the country, one of the things that we should remember is that some other people were coming into the country too. They were called Michalnikim, or volunteers from outside of Israel. They were primarily young men, although there were a handful of women, from many other countries, and they would be coming in to help with the armed forces of the state of Israel. I'm going to tell you two famous ones first. Oh, that, remember I told you about the trucks that they jimmied up with iron? That's a good example of one. That's a regular truck, and look what they did with it to break the blockades. So Machal, there's a program today called Machal as well, which brings people in from outside of Israel. About 3,500 World War II veterans from 58 countries. You know, you get one here and there and whatever. About 123 died in combat. They basically created the Israeli Air Force. And in fact, it would be an American guy named Al Schwimmer who would go over there and help create the Air Force as well as the Israel arms industry. This picture of three Americans who flew planes. They bought them from wherever they could. And we talked about Czechoslovakia last week. After May 15th, 1948, Israel was allowed to bring in arms from everywhere. They didn't have to smuggle them in anymore. Right? They didn't have to have factories underneath washing machines anymore. So they started coming in, and that's a good example of it right there. There he is. Mr. Lovely. Let me tell you a little bit about Vidal Sassoon. I didn't know any of this, so this is really fascinating. Did anybody know that he was a Michalnik?
No.
You knew that? Okay. Anything you can tell us about him?
No, I remember he was there, then he went to Britain, obviously, and created his enterprise. In fact, I have a cousin who actually worked for him when he was at the height of his fame.
Yeah, nice Jewish boy, right? You know, so let's talk.
And also the family, Sassoon family, is one of the more famous Sephardic families.
Right, and there's another wing called Sassouni, which are Indian. And they were originally, I believe, Iraqi Jews who made it over India. There's three types of Indian Jews.
And China.
China I'm not familiar with, to be honest with you. I know about the refugees there.
I think Sassoon built some of the big hotels in China.
He might, Sassoon from India? Or this guy?
From Iraq.
From Iraq, the Sassoon family. Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all. And now we have Sheldon Adelson, who builds the big casinos in China, in Macau, China, apparently makes $1 million an hour or something like that, which is very good for birthright, you know, and a whole bunch of other Jewish enterprises. So there you have the years that he lived. He was the son of a Turkish father and a Ukrainian mother, so it's what we call an intermarriage in those days. He was born in West London. His father walked out when he was only 3 years old. His mother was left destitute. He was put in a synagogue orphanage. He was raised in a synagogue orphanage. During World War II, he was evacuated to the countryside, like a lot of other kids at that time. At 14, he started working in a hair salon. Remember the hair commercial, you know, the shampoo commercial? Now you know the rest of the story. What was that, Revlon or something like that? I can't remember what it was. He joined a group of basically young hoods in London right after World War II who would go around and beat up anti-Semites in London. So he had a little bit of a rough edge to him, which you wouldn't expect from someone like that. One night he had a black eye and he came into work and a customer asked him what happened and he said, "I tripped." You know, and that's one of the famous stories about him. His mother, whom he was still in touch with, was very Zionist. And she basically said to him, "You need to go to Palestine. You know, you need to get yourself in gear." In the 70s and 80s, we always sent kids to Israel to get themselves in shape, to kibbutzim. Right? And that's basically what she said to him. He joined the Haganah in Machal, and look at what he said. "That was the best year of my life. When you think of 2,000 years of being put down and suddenly you were a nation rising, it was a wonderful feeling. There were only 600,000 people defending the country against five armies, so everyone had something to do. I wasn't going over there to sit in an office. I thought if we don't fight for a piece of land and make it work, then the whole Holocaust thing was a terrible waste. But this way, at least we got a country out of it." So he was emblematic of his generation, right? He had some oats to sow. He had a Jewish identity. Why not go there and fight for something that you believe in? Wasn't particularly safe, which was probably exciting to him. Bit adventurous, but he's really the most famous Michalnik. The next most famous one is a guy named Colonel David Mickey Marcus. A couple quick facts about him. Actually, let me run through a couple other facts about him. First you have a few facts there. His code name in Israel was Michael Stone. He designed the command structure of the IDF. He was actually Israel's first general. He was the first Jewish general since 135 CE in a Jewish army. I should say. He built the Burma Road, which we're going to talk about, on old goat trails, which broke the siege of Jerusalem. He is the only American who ever died in a foreign war to be buried at West Point. He served the country honorably in World War II. Even though he was older, he volunteered to go jump out of a parachute on D-Day. He risked his life. It wasn't necessary. He was on command staff. He was quite an interesting guy. Do we have his years there? No. 1901 to 1948. His parents were from Romania. He was born in Hester Street in New York City, famous street. To defend himself, he learned how to box. He was another one of those tough guys. In 1920, he went to West Point, where he did quite well. He served on active duty, and after that, he actually went to law school. He became an attorney as well. He stayed in the Army Reserve as a judge advocate, and he decided to stay in the military, and he rose up through the ranks. Finally, in 1947, an associate of David Ben-Gurion's approached him in New York City. They knew he was a good Jewish guy. He had a lot of experience on command staffs. Ben-Gurion sent a whole bunch of people to the United States to talk to anyone and everyone that he could find who might be able to help build the structure of the state. Remember, Ben-Gurion was a relentless genius. He really was. The War Department said to him, when he said, "I want to go there," he said, "We agree with that if you went under an alias," hence Michael Stone, "so as not to alarm the British." He also designed the hit-and-run tactics for the outnumbered Israelis. First, he was named commander of the Jerusalem Front. He was given the rank of brigadier general. The road to Jerusalem was blocked, as I said, because the Arab Legion was in Latrun. And Latrun was this commanding place there, old fortress. And he, you know, there were many attempts to try and take Latrun. And one of them, a young man named Ariel Sharon, was wounded in the stomach, almost left for dead. One of his friends dragged him to safety. I told you, I think last week, I'm reading a book about Sharon now by a guy named David Landau, and he goes into this extensively. They say to Marcus, "Look, we can't get convoys to Jerusalem if you don't find a way, relief convoys, to get us around that." So he finds out there's a goat trail there. And he says, "You know what? Maybe during what's going to become the first ceasefire, we can build a trail here." And they gave it the nickname the Burma Road, after the famous road in World War II, and it worked. And they got some people in there. I'm going to show you that in a minute. Let's see if here's a picture of the Burma Road. It's very steep, rocky territory. Now it's, you know, a nice, smooth highway. It's easy to get through.
There was a movie about him.
Traffic lately.
Yeah, right.
There was a movie about him called Cast a Giant Shadow. With
Kirk Douglas. Watch an excerpt from that. It's one of my favorite corny movies. Where is it? Hang on a second. To Cast a Giant Shadow, with the lovely Kirk Douglas playing him. Whoop.
Things are not going well.
Ben-Gurion.
Egyptian tanks have been stopped. You've got Jaffa, Haifa, Aden.
He always had access to Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion loved the guy.
Mickey, it's been a disaster. Terrible disaster. The Arab Legion has moved into the fortress of Latrun and cut the only supply road to Jerusalem.
The Arab Legion?
The boys tried to break through yesterday and were slaughtered like cattle. Wheat fields are irrigated with their blood.
That's a real defense minister's speech. Now,
a little dramatic for Ben-Gurion.
Hardly any artillery, not enough men, but most important of all, no centralized leadership. You're right. We have no high command. We have a committee. You know about the ceasefire? The United Nations requested a general truce to go into effect the morning of June 11th.
You accept it?
We don't want to see any more bloodshed on either side. Well, but the Arabs have accepted. You know, you can't break through to Jerusalem in that time.
When the ceasefire comes, the lines will be frozen. The city will have to surrender or be starved to death. We have 2 weeks. Less.
But we've been over all this. What the hell's so important about Jerusalem militarily? Half the city's already fallen. Look, it just doesn't make sense to risk everything you've got just to save the other half.
Did it make sense for a fellow with a nice steady job building pyramids to march his friends into the Red Sea?
Mickey, Jerusalem is starving.
Gotta love it.
3 pieces of bread a week for the children, almost no water. Jerusalem is destroyed once by Nebuchadnezzar, a second time by Titus of Rome. Not again, Mickey, not again. Without Jerusalem, there is no Israel. Defense Minister has made another speech. I'd be interested in knowing how you intend to save it. The Bible is a Hebrew word I've never seen anywhere else. The word is aluf. It means commander. More than that, it means leader. I'm placing the unified command of all forces in the central Jerusalem front in the hands of Aluf Michael Stone. Now, wait a minute. When I first asked the commander it was time to organize, to train, to prepare, this is like giving a kid a balloon when the party's over. I told you, I don't believe in miracles. About miracles, I wouldn't know. But the last Aluf mentioned in the Bible was Joshua, at Jericho. Written a personal note to all brigade commanders announcing your appointment. Would you want to be the first general of the army of Israel in 2,000 years?
It's a little dramatic, but you get the picture.
Just real quickly, we'll see through this too.
They did a relatively good job in the settings.
How long has Conway been hung up here?
2 days. There is hope.
Tell them not to keep their motors running.
And I?
You never turn yours off.
Ami o hebe d'otre.
Huh?
For the love of Zion.
That means I love him. Out of stone. A general should learn that much of the language.
Nobody's going to love you when this fighting's over.
Factual part?
No, he's actually married. He's actually married. His wife wasn't happy he left, also.
Well, do not die, for I
There's actually a book called The Cast of Giant Shadow, which this comes from, which is it's a good read. It really is.
The air smells of cow manure and blood.
This is the song Arza Avinu. On the way to Israel, we go. We go up, yeah. All right, I'm gonna cut it here.
That's Asher.
Oh, wait a second.
Wait a second, all right.
Isn't that Tony Brenner?
Let's see. Joel Brenner.
Is that Tony Brenner?
Hang on.
Joel Brenner's.
Oh, God.
It's about time. It gave in 2 weeks of you. Must be worse trouble than I thought.
Anyway.
Now we're all gonna have to watch it.
It's a good movie.
But I remember when he died.
What do you remember from when he died?
I mean, it was a very sad thing in the apartment buildings in Brooklyn.
I bet.
It's also questionable how he died.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to talk about it in a minute. But what I want to remind you of is that had he lived, he probably would have been the first chief of staff for the country of Israel. Had he lived. However, he wasn't going to live. A few hours before the June 11th truce went into effect, it had been declared a few days earlier, Ben-Gurion said in two weeks, I think it was really a few days earlier, he was out on a patrol. He was outside of Jerusalem. The previous night he had celebrated with his staff the opening of the Burma Road, which really saved the citizens of Jerusalem. Around 4 a.m. he was unable to sleep. He put on a large coat. It was cold. You've been in Jerusalem, in the desert part. It can be windy like that. Some people say from afar he looked like he was an Arab shepherd. Other people say it was a regular coat. You couldn't mistake it. There's a lot of controversy about it. He was wearing, it looked like a white sheet or a blanket. He was challenged by a sentry who asked him for the password. He didn't speak any Hebrew. He didn't speak any Hebrew. He failed to respond. The sentry opened fire. Marcus was killed on the spot. Stonewall Jackson, kind of a similar haunting echo, because if Stonewall Jackson had lived, who knows what would be? And if Mickey Marcus had lived, who knows what would be? He is unfortunately not known at all by younger Jews today. When I was growing up, I was told to read the book. you know, in the 70s. It wasn't that long after he had died, 20, 25 years, something like that. But he is an important figure in modern Israel, because without him, the army still would have been a mess. Because remember, not only did the Haganah not have a really an integrated command, but the Palmach of the Haganah thought it was an elitist movement over on the side, and the Irgun wasn't having an easy time integrating, and the Lehi, the much smaller radicals, were having an even harder time integrating, and he was the one who really put it all together for Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion also liked him for two reasons. One, unlike most diaspora Jews, he was a military man. And you saw in this movie, and that was accurate, he challenged Ben-Gurion. He said, what's important about Jerusalem from a military perspective? It's an interesting question. And that's exactly the type of thing that Ben-Gurion needed to hear at that moment. You know, because I'm sure it said, well, now I have to explain this and rationalize it, he said to himself. So that is Colonel David Mickey Marcus. And a very likable fellow by everything that I've heard. We have the Burma Road. One of the things that he helped do was consolidate Israel's defense forces at the beginning of the war, but I'm going to give you a little sketch of that. December 5th, 47, Ben-Gurion declares conscription for all men and women, age 17 to 25. That would go up to age 40. I don't know what reserve duty is in Israel today. I think it's 40 as 45. Well. What is it?
45.
45? Okay, I thought it had dropped down again. But, okay. May 28th, so this is about 2 weeks after the state is declared, Ben-Gurion merges the separate forces. However, Jerusalem is outside of the plan for the state of Israel. So the Irgun and the Lehi and a little bit Haganah are fighting, well, definitely Haganah, are fighting in Jerusalem against the Arabs as well, but they're just not coordinating stuff together. So it's a difficult, tense situation. By the end of 48, the IDF had about 88,000 soldiers. This is how quickly it rose, about 60,000 combat. The Israeli Navy had three whole ships. The Air Force had about 87 planes. So we're not talking about a major thing. I found this picture earlier today. I just had to put it here because I'd never seen it before. Irgun women at a women's training base, which was a house in Jerusalem. And you don't hear that part of the story. And I'm going to look at that a little more for when we do our talk on women in Israel as well. But you don't often hear about women in the Irgun. For more information on that, you can look at the Jewish Women's Archive, which we talked about, I want to say last semester, but last course. And I know you got lost, Joanne, on Women's Archive a few times. I did too.
Still do.
The writing is really good. I mean, there's really a good depth of information there. All right. One of the things, let's see. I'm going to get to this one in a second. We talked a little bit last week about smuggling weapons in. Now we don't have to smuggle weapons. And I just want to mention a few things. I don't have a separate slide on that, but we'll get to this. I think it's a neat graphic as well. Haganah, or Jewish agency, or Israeli government agents were going across the United States and everywhere else, we did mention last week, buying things for scrap metal. They were buying C-46 transport planes, dozens of half-tracks. They were repainted and labeled agricultural vehicles so they would get through U.S. customs, because the U.S. had a military embargo on Israel for several years. It had one on the Arab states as well, but the Arab states were able to purchase weapons from elsewhere. But it was still very hard to get weapons. They scoured Western Europe. They found 50 65 millimeter French mountain guns, 12 120 millimeter mortars. Does anybody know? Yeah.
Where was all the money coming from to finance all of this?
We mentioned last week a guy named Rudolf Sonneborn, who got together with, he was a very wealthy guy in New York City, and Ben-Gurion asked him to get some other wealthy Jews together and basically have a parlor meeting and say, give us your money, Jews need guns. There's even a quote, and I just can't find it again, but I know I've read it, of a Jewish gangster. And a Haganah guy went to the Jewish gangster and told him that they needed weapons, and he said, Jews want to fight back? I'm in. So there were all types of ways to smuggle stuff in. Wealthy Jews in the diaspora were paying for it.
Wasn't Golda Meir sent over to...
When did she get the $50 million?
Golda Meir was sent over before the state, and then again after the state, when she's named foreign minister, to do that. Yes. Absolutely. She was one of the people, and she, that was for Israel Bonds, the big mission that you're talking about. And the Israel Bonds money was basically fungible, and it was used for anything the government needed at that point.
They also collected guns from the U.S.
Right, that's exactly what we're talking about, surplus guns from World War II. And keep in mind, they're also making weapons. You know, now they can do it out in the open. Now, smuggling in some material to make those weapons is another story as well. And they're just opening. We're actually going to talk about this next week. They're beginning to open ties with France, which is going to change everything in terms of weapons and nuclear power, the secret in Dimona that nobody knows about, and so on and so on, that no one's known about since the mid-50s. All right, a major supplier was Czechoslovakia. They got fighter planes, thousands of rifles, machine guns, millions of rounds of ammunition. The Haganah had 12 cargo ships in Europe waiting for the British mandate to end, sitting there waiting to bring weapons in. So that's one example. And a number of them were leaving from France in particular. Meanwhile, the Israelis, the Jews, were stealing weapons from the British. The British were in a state of chaos in some regards. They were breaking up camps. There were some Jews in the British army. There were some sympathizers in the British army. The Jews were doing everything that they could. This was a major, major thing. Ben-Gurion knew this. One British soldier, a guy named Mike Flanagan, not the Oriole pitcher, may rest in peace. Anybody remember the year he won Cy Young Award?
1779.
You got it. You got it. British Mike Flanagan, he was an Irishman who helped liberate Bergen-Belsen. He was stationed in Palestine. He was very sympathetic to the Jews.
The Irish
were sympathetic because they saw it as a similar nationalist issue.
And that's why they're pro-Palestinian now.
I have a good friend who lives in Ireland who's from here, and I talk to him periodically. He says it's really scary stuff. The day before, I love this one, the day before the last British troops left Haifa, he and one other soldier got into two Cromwell tanks. They drove through the unguarded gates of the base. They delivered it to Tel Aviv, where Haganah operatives were waiting, and these were the first heavy tanks that Israel had. They literally drove them out of the base to Tel Aviv. So these types of things were happening. By the way, he married an Israeli woman and converted to Judaism. Weapons production was moving ahead. Does anyone know what a Davidka was? Tell me what a Davidka was.
It was a very loud, very inefficient type of mortar, but it was very helpful because it really scared the Arabs, just hearing it.
Right. Basically, you shoved a lot of scrap metal in it, and you lit a fuse, and it went up, and it made this whistling sound, and it exploded in midair, and the Arabs thought that some horrible weapon was raining down on them. And in Jerusalem, in a couple spots, they have Davidka monuments, if you've ever seen them. Yeah, and so far, I haven't seen it in Safat, but I've seen it in Jerusalem as well. But that was one of the you know, famous things, and it was very demoralizing for the enemy. And remember, a lot of the Arabs who were coming in to fight in Jerusalem and Israel and Palestine and whatever you want to call it, they weren't motivated, right? They were conscripts for their country. There were some irregulars that they call that were kind of just coming in over the border and creating all types of problems. But there wasn't a high motivation. It made a huge, huge difference. And with the British leaving, the Jews could conscript people. Let me tell you this slide first, and then I think, let me see if I have the Jewish one. Yeah, Israel forces at the invasion. So let me tell you these guys first. So the Arab forces at the invasion, remember the Palestinians had some training too in the British police force. And 7,000 Palestinians served in the British army. A lot more Jews did. But some Palestinians did. There was something called the Arab Liberation Army. Jordan's Arab Legion had about 10,000 people, and they were pretty successful in the war because they focused just on one area, which was the West Bank in Jerusalem.
And they were led by the British.
What?
They were led by the
They were
British.
Led by John Glubb, G-L-U-B-B. I've never read it, but he has an autobiography about his time there. Their command structure was British.
Pasha Glubb.
Yeah, Pasha Glubb. That's right. The Iraqi army gave 3,000 soldiers, and Iraqi airplanes came and dropped bombs on Israel. They were under Jordanian command. There was a lot of tension there because the Iraqis wanted to push on more, but King Abdullah said, no, I don't want to do that, because remember, Abdullah had that agreement with the Israelis and with Golda Meir, you know, lead me to the West Bank. Egypt's army obviously came up through the Sinai. Syria had 12,000 soldiers at the war's start. They added some as the war went on. Even Lebanon gave 3,500 men. Initially it was 1,000. They weren't a major factor. They really weren't a major factor. They were quickly defeated on that front. Even the Saudis sent some men, and then Sudan, Yemen, and Morocco sent small groups as well. So the Arab world was against Medinat Yisrael, the new state of Israel. And it's important to remember that this was a major, major war in the region. And for the most part, war had stayed out of the region in World War II. Right? There had been uprisings in the 20s and 30s in Palestine. There had been tensions in Egypt. There had been some fighting in Syria and Lebanon against the Vichy French, but nothing on this scale. So here's the Israeli forces of the invasion. July 1948, they had 63,000 people. A year later, they had 115,000. At the beginning of the war, they weren't allowed to put everyone in the military, you know, before the state was declared. And then slowly they were able to build up, and you have some immigrants coming in as well. And as things get bad, particularly in the beginning of the war, more and more people want to help serve. I'm going through a lot. Does anybody have any questions? No? Yeah.
Are you going to touch base on this strategy, the strategic aspects of the war? And full disclosure, last week I heard Ari Shavit.
Okay.
He was a Tzikamuna.
Right.
But I also, in his book, My Promised Land,
yeah, Brad.
He makes a lot of assertions that clearly the part of the strategy of the Israelis was to either kill or get the Arabs to leave.
Right. So we talked a little bit, if you remember last week, that there's some theories, you know, initially, you know, I grew up on the notions of, well, the Arabs were told to leave by their people, by their commanders. They were told to flee. They'd come back. They'd have the Jewish homes and all that. The Arabs, of course, say the Jews kicked us all out. Other people say they fled during war. And the answer to which one it was is yes. All three took place on various levels. There are places like Lida and Ramla in which Arabs were expelled. There's a famous scene where somebody says to Ben-Gurion, what do we do with the Arabs in Ramla? And it goes like this. And he walks away, but he doesn't say anything, so it can't be recorded. And there are some, but not many, broadcasts of Arab leaders saying leave, and many people just fled because it was war. Keep in mind that before the war, in the Civil War phase, from late November to mid-May, those with money left, right? Which hurt the Arabs or the Palestinians even more, because their leadership had abandoned them. So they left on their own volition. So certainly people in villages who didn't know from nothing and probably didn't have radios didn't leave until they saw columns of tanks coming forward. So all of it happened. I don't know if Shavit said the same thing. I don't remember that section of the book, but that's what the history tells us. And what I think we're going to do now is when we come back, we're going to talk about the three phases of the war. Oh, question first.
Well, I just wanted to say that in the readings that we had for tonight, they made it very clear that they didn't want any rear flanks of Arab villages.
Absolutely.
And so, knowing that, you know that there was effort to move them out.
Absolutely. And particularly in that area around Tel Aviv, Lida and Ramla, in those areas. In the Galilee, it was a little different. In Haifa, the mayor actually went around knocking on doors, asking Arabs to stay. So there's a mixed picture. And the general rule was, if you don't fight us, we won't fight you. But if you're on a strategic hill, particularly around Jerusalem, we're going to kick you out.
We don't want you behind us.
Right, exactly. We don't want a fifth column.
In Lawrence Wright's new book on
right, you mentioned,
you know, the 13 days, he talks about more Israeli massacres during the war.
There is a lot of talk about Israeli massacres. There is a lot of talk about Arab massacres. We talked about Deir Yassin last week. Again, Lida is another one of them. There were some bad things that happened. I wouldn't give it, I wouldn't equate it with certain other things.
No,
I would say it's wartime. If people commit atrocities, they should be held accountable for them. But I wouldn't say that was the policy or across the board.
No.
if the Israelis wanted all the Arabs out of what they thought were Arab, were Israeli lands, they would be gone. So somehow there's still hundreds of thousands of Arabs still living there.
It was 1.2 million.
Back then.
Oh, then, okay.
Back then. So if the Israelis at the time wanted them to expel every Arab, they would have been gone. The Israelis had the military strength to do it.
Keep in mind, there were about 1.1, 1.2 million Arabs in late 47. By the end of the war, 750,000 flee. So the vast majority do leave.
Hundreds of thousands remain.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting, and hopefully we'll have time to get to it tonight. A guy named Benny Morris, who has come full circle in some regards, has said Ben-Gurion made a huge mistake by not kicking out all the Arabs when he could. Now, keep in mind, this is very difficult stuff to talk about. There are population exchanges at this point. India is the best example. None of it is necessarily good. None of it is necessarily without, you know, tremendous human suffering. And we saw that slide last... Hang on a second. We saw that slide last week of the Palestinians going across the Jordan with their stuff on their back. Right? And that's, you know, as a human being, you really have to feel. That's very, very difficult stuff. And we still don't have the answers to this. And we're not going to answer it tonight. But we might when we get to lesson 17 or 18. Did you want to say something else, Mitch?
Just that there were a lot of relocations at the time. In Europe, there people were being relocated, so it wasn't uncommon.
Still going on.
The world was and is in flux. Nationalism can be a beautiful thing. It can be a disastrous thing. Right? You know, that reminds me. You ought to all read Hobsbawm again for next week. No. All right, let's take 5 quick minutes and go from there. Okay, so obviously keep on eating because I know I would. That's the wrong slide. So this was the scene on May 15th, 1948. Literally at midnight, a couple hours after Ben-Gurion had declared the state, Arab troops moved in. Why didn't they move in until midnight? Anyone know?
The British.
The British legally controlled the shops. Yeah, yeah. They were late from shul. You know, they didn't plug in the cholent. State declared the Arab armies invade. Everybody knew it was coming. It wasn't a surprise. The plan: Syria and Lebanon are going to take the north. The loose plan: Jordan and Iraq are coming from the east to take Jerusalem and the West Bank. Egypt comes from the south. This is a horrible scenario. This is really a horrible scenario. Right? 5 regular armies and a lot of irregulars are coming. You're not really that well organized. You have some experience, but you don't have any experience fighting armies. Right? You have experience fighting Arab bands, marauders, what have you.
Neil?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. So based on that plan that you articulated where the Syria, Lebanon, we're going to take part of. Is there any articulation of documents back then that said, you know, there's not going to be a Palestinian state? The Syrians and the Lebanese are going to take what they take, keep it.
Right.
The Jordanians already had, you know, what they wanted.
And indeed, that's what happened, right? With Egypt, with Gaza, and the, right, so.
Right, but I'm just curious if there was any documentation that said, after the fact, you know, we'll constitute a Palestinian state as we see it, or we're
right.
just going to take it and...
So here's the real problem that nobody talks about, the historians. The Arab archives are lousy, they're not open, and the sources aren't always trustworthy. And Westerners, other than that, everything's fine. And Westerners don't speak Arabic, right? Westerners generally don't speak Arabic. It's very hard to do research in Arab lands, particularly Arab countries where there are dictatorships. It's not like Israel, where everyone in the world is publishing his or her memoirs, right? So you can get the real story. But we know that clearly King Abdullah said, I want the West Bank. King Hussein didn't give up the West Bank until 1987. When he said, I'm giving it to the Palestinians now. So that's a long time. The Egyptians never said that they wanted to give up Gaza. Right? So it's the actions that speak as loudly as the intent.
There was never any plan to have a Palestinian state.
Well, there was by the Palestinians and by the United Nations.
Yeah. But not by the Powers that were there.
The Jews had said there's going to be a Palestinian state, basically because we can't do anything about it. But yeah, so it depends on what direction you want to come from. Right? There was going to be a Palestinian state according to...
On paper.
According to the UN plan.
But in reality, the Egyptians were going to carve out their piece, and the Lebanese and Syrians were going to carve out their...
Yeah, more the Syrians.
There was no indigenous... creation of any kind of administrative infrastructure to organize, to be ready to form any kind of government.
You hit it, because the Palestinians weren't used to the concept, as David said, of statehood. They felt that they were the majority, so they didn't have to worry about it. Their leadership left from November 47 until May 15, 48. As is the case today, by the way, one of the ways you can trace this is you look at the population of Arab Christians. 40, 50 years ago, there were a lot more Arab Christians. They're generally more educated. They generally had more money. And again, these are stereotypes. So they leave. Same thing happened in Lebanon, too, not just in Israel. Right? The Lebanese Christian community is a lot smaller now, too. That's a roundabout way of coming back to the fact, as I like to say, yes and yes. Some people believed there was going to be a Palestinian state. The other Arab countries weren't really interested in that. In fact, they were interested in getting at the Jews and imperialism, because that was an Arab land. And by the way, the situation historically for Palestine, whatever you want to call it, was never really clear. It was a province of the Ottoman Empire. It was southern Syria at various times. Nobody necessarily saw it as an individually large structure. Remember, when the Jews started arriving in 1882, there weren't that many Palestinian Arabs. More started coming when the Jews built up the economy. And healthcare got better in the 20th century, so there was a lower mortality rate. And these were people with larger families. Right? So there's a lot of factors at play here. So yes and yes is the... politically correct, as well as I believe the accurate answer.
It really wasn't until the fall of Nasser that it came into the Palestinian state. Up until then, it was just a pan-Arab spirit.
You know, I mean, projecting forward, I guess the great moment, quote-unquote, in Palestinian nationalism is when Arafat is invited to go before the UN in 74. And, you know, there's a whole big dispute as he's got a pistol holder on it. Now, some people say he had a pistol holder. Some people say he had a pistol. I can't tell from the pictures. I've tried it. But he says, you know, don't let me drop the olive branch and pick up the pistol. Like, you know, he hadn't picked up a pistol in the past. So that's a whole different story. Yes?
The other thing about the governance, and in 48, I mean, they were the tribal, and the Mufti thought he was going to become the dictator of the area.
Well, keep in mind that Husseini leaves the area in 38 because the British are hunting him, and he goes to Syria and Lebanon, and he eventually winds up in Berlin. So he hasn't been in the area in a long time. Then he dies, I think, in 75 or 71, I always get it mixed up, in Lebanon, in Beirut. So the Mufti is out of the picture, although he'd like to come back and be the leader. He would like to come back and be the leader, but he's out of the picture. You know, as in terms of having any power whatsoever. All right. Yes, ma'am.
How many fronts are they fighting?
Okay, well, let's take a look. You've got the Southern Front, and indeed, this is the way Israel is divided today in terms of military. You have what you would call the Central Command. So they're coming here from they're moving west, coming from the east. And you have the Northern Command. So they're coming in from Lebanon and Syria. So it's primarily three. There really wasn't any action on the seas.
Nothing. Okay.
Yeah. These countries didn't have well-developed navies. As David can tell you, he's got a grandson that serves in the Israeli Navy today. Israel primarily has gunboats. They don't have destroyers or anything like that. They don't need them. They have merchant marine ships, you know, cargo ships, but they just have very fast boats that patrol, and every now and then patrol up in Lebanon when they're not supposed to. But we don't talk about that. All right. So... Ehud Barak never wore a dress in 1975 in Beirut. What? They do have submarines. And in fact, it's one of the bizarre things in history, if you think about it. In 1991, do you know what Israel got as a prize, quote-unquote, for staying out of the Gulf War? They got some nuclear submarines from Germany, of all places. Go figure. Go figure.
That's where they get all their submarines.
Yeah, yeah, from Germany. I think they're Dolphin-class submarines.
They know how to make good submarines.
Did you read the book The Last Israeli about the nuclear sub?
No.
It's really worth it.
I've never even heard of it.
Oh, it's about, I think back B.C.K. It was like a year or so ago. What happens is, what would happen if this nuclear sub was submerged? They call back home, there's no Israel. What would they do? Would they launch the missiles or not?
Wow.
That's a nuclear
sub. Wow, the doomsday scenario. Yeah. Yeah. It's some heavy stuff. All right. Any more questions on this? Okay, let me move on. All right, one of the famous battles was at a kibbutz named Yad Mordechai. Has anyone ever been there?
Yes.
So they have this cheesy replica in the field there of the tin soldiers and tanks to replicate the battle. But Yad Mordechai is an important place because it's named for Mordechai Analevich, who was the commander of the Jewish youth group, basically commanded the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And they have a beautiful statue of him there as well. Egypt wanted Tel Aviv. That was the prize. Tel Aviv is the center. Standing in its way was Kibbutz Yad Mordechai, which was a pretty small place. 2,500 Egyptians attacked from the south. Fierce resistance from 130 Israelis. Make every bullet count. One machine gun, one anti-tank weapon. They were held off for 5 days in heavy losses. They were basically smuggled out the back door by the Haganah. There's some great maps on, I've seen of the battle on various websites. If you have about 600 hours, all this stuff is online. And, just research it for a couple years and, various languages, it's terrific. It's amazing what's online. May 23rd, the third attack, they were finally captured. As I said, they were evacuated by Haganah. The Egyptians didn't know that. They waited even longer, and they hammered the kibbutz for more hours with artillery. That gave the Haganah enough time to regroup its defenses on the road to Tel Aviv. Little miracles like that happened all the time in this war. Now, I taught my kids, by the way, in high school today, we did this whole exercise on the meaning of fate. And, then it got into the God discussion and all that. I go back and forth on that junk all the time. This stuff makes me believe. Other stuff makes me disbelieve because, you put it next to the Holocaust. And, because as I told the kids, just the commercial, if you believe God is responsible for everything that's good, aren't you supposed to believe that God's responsible for everything bad? So, anyway, we'll talk about that after class. This gave vital time to the defenders of South Tel Aviv. They repelled the advancing Egyptians. Yad Mordechai wasn't retaken until November. Mideast wars don't last a long time. This is the longest war that Israel has fought, if you don't count the Intifada, which actually wasn't existential in a military sense to Israel. And the Intifadas, I should say. But it's worth taking a visit down there, down the south. Now we come to Latrun. Many of you recognize this. It's the site of the Armored Corps Museum today. It's an old fortress on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv road. Like I said, it's across from a beautiful old monastery, which is hundreds of years old. It's a commanding view of the valley. The Arab Legion, which is Jordan, comes in. They take Latrun. They command the area. They cut the supplies to Jerusalem. This is considered the West Bank, right? You go there today, you're like, you're kidding, right? This is the road to Jerusalem. I mean, raise your hand if you've been there. It's a cool place. Right, it's a neat thing to say. Israelis try to take it 5 times. They want that because that will relieve Jerusalem. And we, get to Mickey Marcus and the Burma Pass. I told you about Sharon in the past. And that's where Sharon and others get the mantra of no one's left behind. Which is not always true, but it means you make every effort to get somebody. Stayed in Arab hands until the Six-Day War. It was one of the first things that they tried to get at that point. So the fighting in the early battles starts off very, very difficult, but the Jews are holding their own, which is surprising a lot of people. The UN declares a truce. Not quite a month, 28 days. In this truce, Both sides cheat like crazy. Weapons come pouring into the region. They're preparing for round two. In some regards, it's not unlike the last 5-6 years with Hamas and Israel. Just waiting for the next round. Waiting for the next round. 86 planes come from Czechoslovakia. All of a sudden, Israel has an air force. Literally, there are stories of people leaning out of these planes dropping Molotov cocktails. Right? So they're so low, they're being shot at. You don't have bombs on planes like this. Right? It's, you know, this is very rudimentary. And keep in mind, you have a lot of these foreigners who are adventurers and think it's great. By the way, one of the more dangerous things that happens is a couple of British airplanes cross the border from Egypt and the Israelis shoot them down. That becomes a big major international incident. And the Israelis basically said, you wandered in a combat zone. The IDF increases in strength. The Arabs are bringing in truce. Benny Morris, the historian I talked about, who was kind of the godfather of the revisionist historians. When I say a revisionist historian, basically what that means is these are people that mine the archives and try and tell a different perspective of the narratives that we all grew up with. Like I said, one of the narratives was the Arab leadership told their people to leave. Partly true, but not necessarily according to the records. If the truce began, a British officer stationed in Haifa, because remember there were still some Brits in Haifa, said that the four-week-long truce would certainly be exploited by the Jews to continue military training and reorganization while the Arabs would waste them feuding over the future divisions of the spoils. The Arabs were horribly organized. King Abdullah didn't trust anybody, the Egyptians didn't trust anybody, and so on and so on and so on. The Jews were united because Ben-Gurion shoved unity down their throat. Right? He disbands the Palmach at one point, this is a little later, but he basically says, no, you're not going to be different, you're not going to be elite. The way he does this, by the way, is he says to them, we need to make Palmach, you know, attitudes affect the whole army, not just you separate guys over here. So the fighting, there's still a little bit of skirmishes, but really not much. It's really under control. The population takes a breather, but one of the things that happens is the Altalena. Some of us know about the Altalena. What do we know about the Altalena?
Palmach tried to smuggle weapons in.
You mean the air gun?
Air gun. Mm-hmm. And Ben-Gurion blew it up.
Ben-Gurion said, no, that's not going to happen. Ben-Gurion blew it up. Anything else? I'm going to give you some more details, but I want to see what you know first.
Wasn't Menachem Begin?
Yeah, Begin was on the ship. Begin was on the ship when it was being fired on. He was one of the last off. Rabin was the commander of the troops on the shore. Rabin was the guy that ultimately gave the order to fire. Let me give you a kind of a little nutshell. Remember what I had said, that the Irgun had its separate forces in Jerusalem. Now, the Irgun actually had basically separate units in the Israel Defense Forces. Right? They said, okay, we're going to merge into the Israel Defense Forces, but we want our own units. So Begin says, look, we've purchased these weapons, and what we want to do during the truce is bring them into Israel and distribute them to our troops. So Ben-Gurion says, it ain't going to work that way, baby. They're for everybody. You're going to bring them in, you're going to give them to us, and we're going to decide where they go. Begin says, that's not going to happen. Ben-Gurion says, if it doesn't happen, we're going to have basically to attack you. Begin says, no, you're not going to attack us. So, and remember, these are guys that have a nasty history. Ben-Gurion sends the Haganah troops during the Sezon to attack the Irgun troops. Right? Some of them are imprisoned. We saw a slide last week at one of the kibbutzim where they were imprisoned. So, what happens on June 11th, this ship called the Altalena, which is named for Jabotinsky, sets sails from France. Begin sends a wire that says, wait, stay out in the sea, don't land, wait till the ceasefire. We'll be able to sneak you guys in there too. Ben-Gurion says, as I said to you, that's not going to happen. Ultimately, Ben-Gurion agrees that 20% is going to go to your troops. Begin says, no, it's not. And Ben-Gurion says, you're not going to fire an army. You're not going to have an army within an army. I've already gone through that. I'm not dealing with that again. So to cut a long story short and all the details, goes to a place called Kfar Vitkin, which is around Haifa, and it decides not to land there and comes south to Tel Aviv, where you see the picture it's going to fire on. Ben-Gurion meets with top advisors and decides to send word to Begin to give all the weapons to the IDF. He says, forget it. Ben-Gurion says, we must decide whether to hand over power to Begin or to order him to cease his separate activities. If he does not do so, we will open fire. Otherwise, we must decide to disperse our own army. Ben-Gurion was a man of values and principle, and he was incredibly stubborn. So, this is what the brigade commander says at Kfar Vitkin. I'm empowered to Begin. I'm empowered to confiscate the weapons and military materials which have, this is a note, which have arrived on the Israeli coast in the area of my jurisdiction in the name of the Israel government. You're required to carry out this order immediately. If you do not agree to carry out this order, I shall use all the means at my disposal in order to implement the order and to requisition the weapons which have reached shore and transfer them from private possession into the possession of the Israel government. You have 10 minutes to give your answer. This is the result. There's a firefight, by the way, that breaks out on the beach as well. Some people are killed. Don't think that Begin ever forgot this when it came to Yitzhak Rabin. And who did Begin replace as prime minister? Yitzhak Rabin. Right? So, very interesting scenario. The country, again, was on the verge of civil war. Somehow they were able to calm everybody down because there was a higher priority. The ceasefire was about to stop. And the second phase was going to start. In the second phase, Israel launches simultaneous offenses on three fronts. Now they're pushing to secure the old city of Jerusalem. It doesn't go well. There are many pictures and scenes of primarily Orthodox Jews being evacuated from the old city of Jerusalem, and we know what's going to happen there. There's a push toward the area east of Tel Aviv. This is what Joanne, you were talking about in terms of many of the villages there were evacuated. People were told to leave. Moshe Dayan writes a lot about this in his autobiography. And there was a push for the Galilee, to control the Galilee, which was a majority Arab population as well. But there had always been kibbutzim strategically located there. And remember, Jews had helped lay roads there. Remember Gidud Avodah, the labor brigade that we talked about last year. They were literally crushing stone and, you know, creating bulldozers and all that. This is a little low. Sorry, I'm learning how to work this technology. An Egyptian artillery piece captured. So that was the second phase of the war. And there's going to be yet another ceasefire that comes into being. And of course, I'm skipping a part. Actually, I'm not going to skip this part. Anybody ever hear of Count Bernadette?
He was the
UN.
Yeah, he was assassinated.
Yes, he was assassinated. UN mediator. Guess who assassinated him?
Jews.
You know, definitely Jews. What type of Jews? They assassinated Lord Moyne, too. If you remember that name. Lehi. Right? He was traveling through motorcade through Jerusalem. They came up upon him. Basically, he had had a team, he had had a plan in which Jerusalem again would be an internationalized city and what have you. They were afraid that this would be accepted. Remember, they're operating on their own, right? Jerusalem is free territory. The state of Israel doesn't control even West Jerusalem at this point. Three-man team, many believe a guy named Yitzhak Shamir was involved in this team. We believe he was involved with the Lord Moyne assassination as well. We don't know this for really. He's very ambiguous about it in his autobiography, which I think was here one of the weeks. It's called Summing Up. And he died not too many years ago. Anyway, this was quickly condemned by everybody. Abba Ibn, who is the representative ostensibly to the diplomatic corps, attends his funeral in Sweden to try and make nice with everybody. This gives Ben-Gurion the chance he needs to disarm Lehi and their overwhelming forces. They basically have no choice. They have had a very difficult integration into what's now the Israel Defense Forces. Nobody was ever charged with killing. This is all stuff we always talk about, how we remember and so-and-so remembers. The United Nations remembers this stuff as well. Anybody know who his replacement was?
Ralph Bunch.
Ralph Bunch. And he won the?
Nobel Peace Prize.
Nobel Prize for what he did there. That's right. That's right. A lot of people have won Nobel Prizes for trying to make peace in the Middle East. Hopefully one of them will actually succeed. All right. So a third phase comes into being. The war is really divided into three phases. A new partition is proposed by the United Nations. It is rejected pretty roundly by both sides. There's a new push now by the Israelis to secure the borders. This is where they really take the Negev. This is where they really push the Egyptians out of the Negev. And they really are solidifying everything at this point. The ceasefire is, there's a ceasefire, it's broken again. The Israel that we know from 1949 to 1967 is solidified in this phase. We're going to talk more about it next week, but by early 49, there are not peace treaties, but armistice accords being signed with the Arab countries. You know, the armistice, there's nothing sacred, just so you know, about the 67 border. It's literally a negotiated diplomatic political solution to a military conflagration. Or I'm trying to think of a better word, to a military situation. All right. So, this is Eilat. Anybody been to Eilat? There's a couple Arab shacks there at that time. It was a Rash Rash. The Israelis went and hung their flag up there. And, you know, just as now, they didn't really have any problem with the Jordanian city across the way. If, you know, every now and then you read in the newspapers, you know, a boat or a water skier or something like that crossed the border. You know, it's really, really no big deal. One of the tragedies of the war is that the city of Jerusalem is split. The Israel Defense Forces kept trying in various ways to get in there. It was very difficult to do. Some of you know the terrain. There are hills. There's an old city with a huge wall, which is pretty easy to defend if you're up on the wall. Bullets aren't going to get through it. The Jordanians tragically sacked the Jewish quarter. The Churva Synagogue, which I used to love it when it was a memorial to what was there. I remember it had the arch going across, if anyone has seen it. Well, they reopened it a few years ago. It was a beautiful rebuilt synagogue. It had been there, you know, for hundreds of years. Has anyone been in that rebuilt part of the synagogue? Does anybody know what I'm talking? Yeah, you've been there?
Yeah.
So I haven't been inside. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I remember when it opened and the president of Israel went there and all that. I just kind of liked it when it was a memorial to what was. But the next time I'm in Israel, I'll go there. My wife's aunt and uncle live in the old city, and we usually stay with them. There are many stories about the Jordanians taking tombstones from the Mount of Olives and paving sidewalks. I think the Ambassador Hotel on the top of the mountain next to the Mount of Olives is where that took place. There was nothing left. They absolutely destroyed it.
They destroyed all the synagogues.
Yeah, in the old city. In the old city. Yeah, they destroyed all, because, and there were no Jews there anymore, obviously. So, Jewish residents in the old city came to an end. There had been Jewish residents in the old city probably since the walls of the original walls of the old city, 1950 BCE, something like that. Even when the Romans destroyed the city, there were still a handful of Jewish families, actually not in the old city, but right outside of Jerusalem. Maimonides writes about a handful of Jewish families being there in the 12th century when he goes there. So this is a very tragic moment in Jewish history. Same thing in Hebron, which had been freed of Jews, quote-unquote, since the 29 riots. A handful had gone back, really not many. And remember, I always like to give you the other side, a handful of Arabs had saved a handful of Jews in the Hebron riot of 1929. But this is a good picture of the, you know, the tragedy and the destruction that took place. We talked a little bit about this last week. I want to talk about it again. This is the reality. Palestinians fleeing their homes with what they could have. Huge controversy, which continues until this day, obviously. in terms of, you know, what to do about this, what's just, what's unjust. What we do know is that 750,000 Palestinian Arabs left. Some of them can't wait to come back and have the keys. I've heard those stories. Some of them just want financial compensation. Some of them don't want to hear from it. They'd rather integrate into whatever country they're in now, and so on and so on and so on. But it was a human tragedy. Absolutely a human tragedy. I had this up last week. I want this up again so we understand what happened. This becomes particularly important when we talk about the Six-Day War in 67. 280,000 go to the West Bank. 190,000 go to the Gaza Strip. So, you know, they're going to meet the Israelis again. And one of the things we talked about, too, is that while, quote-unquote, only 70,000 went to Jordan, the country today is, depending on who you want to believe, between 65 and 75% Palestinian.
And Syrian refugees.
Well, yeah, now more recently. More recently, absolutely. And I don't know the numbers on the Syrian refugees. I know about 2 million people have been displaced, but I don't know.
Close to a million.
Hmm?
Close to a million.
I thought it was more than that, actually. Some might have gone over to Iraq also.
It also includes people that live traditionally in what is now Jordan who are not Bedouin.
Right.
So these were not.
Well, no, I've seen it as Palestinian. They're traditionally, most people in Jordan were Bedouin. Right, that's when
in the west, on the eastern part, yes, but I think there were people who traditionally lived across the Jordan, the east.
Right, we have Amman up here, for example. Yeah,
Palestine.
I'd have to look at the numbers again, and if you find sources on that, definitely bring them. That would be great. But this is when they talk about the Palestinian diaspora. This is how it started. Some made their way to Europe, some made their way to the United States. There have been a handful of repatriation cases where people have come back to Israel. Not many, but there is a handful of that. You know, the issue today, of course, and again, week 17, 18, 19, we'll talk more about it. These people have no place to come home to if they're actually going to come home. I mean, their villages are gone. And if you want to look at any more information on that, a guy named Meron Benvenisti used to have something called the West Bank Data Project, and he's chronicled all this, which is really quite interesting. All right. I talked about Benny Morris a few minutes ago. Benny Morris is an important guy. For one reason, he's important because his research is really, really good. You might not like his conclusions, but he mines the archives constantly. He's written a lot of really interesting books. Him, Tom Segev, people like that. You know, early in his career, he was the bel enfant of new historians, revisionist historians. It wasn't very popular when he started in the mid and early 80s to challenge the founding myths of the State of Israel. For example, like the one I told you about Joseph Trumpeldor. Anyone remember what his famous last words were? The guy who fell in 1920 at Tel Chai? He allegedly had said, Tov Lamud Le'Artzecha, or Medinacha, good to die for your country. Further research has come out and said that he probably cursed in Russian. Right? So that's the type of stuff that Benny Morris uncovers, but that's a light one. Haaretz is a left-wing newspaper in Israel, which does really interesting stuff. Whether you agree, right, left, whatever, they interview all types of people, and it's really interesting. So he told Haaretz in 2004, and if I recall correctly, this being Israel, the journalist got in a fight with him about it, because, you know, it's Israel. A Jewish state would not have come into being without the uprooting of 700,000 Palestinians. Therefore, it was necessary to uproot them. And, you know, this is a little bit revisionist in its own right. They weren't uprooted, many of them fled. Right, just like anyone would flee a battlefield. There was no choice but to expel that population. It was necessary to cleanse the hinterland and cleanse the border areas and cleanse the main roads. It was necessary to cleanse the villages from which our convoys and our settlements were fired on. So this is dangerous language he's using. You have to put things in proportion. These are small war crimes. Not if you're one of these people. All told, if we take all the massacres and all the executions of 48, we come to about 800 who were killed. Someone earlier asked about that number. I don't remember who it was, about how many were massacred. In comparison to the massacres that were perpetuated in Bosnia, that's peanuts. In comparison to the massacres the Russians perpetuated against the Germans at Stalingrad, that's chicken feed. When you take into account that there was a bloody civil war here and that we lost an entire 1% of the population, you find that we behaved very well. I would say to you that it's dangerous for Jews to compare themselves to other people in any situation. Right? There's something called Jewish values, and it's very fair to have a fight over Jewish values. But don't compare yourself to the situation of others. My mother told me that when I was a kid. My mother still tells me that. It's really irritating. There are circumstances in history that justify ethnic cleansing. I know that this term is completely negative in the discourse of the 21st century, but when the choice is between ethnic cleansing and genocide, the annihilation of your people, I prefer ethnic cleansing. Ben-Gurion, in the end, he faltered. If he had carried out a full expulsion rather than a partial one, he would have stabilized the state of Israel for generations. Wow. This was a bombshell when it hit. Excuse the pun. But it was an absolute bombshell when it hit. I could find many other Israeli writers that totally disagree with this. And I'm Shavit. Do you remember what... Did Shavit address this issue?
Yeah, he basically has the same line. He talks about the same thing. And he defends it the same way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Shavit is known as a pretty liberal guy, or at least he started out that way.
He's a reporter for Haaretz.
Yeah, he's an editor of that now, I think, or a columnist or something like that. To be a columnist in Israel is a big deal.
Right.
You know, that's, you know, columnists are sages in Israel. So, against my better judgment, I'll ask you what you think. What David has something to say first.
You know, it's interesting because you started off, Neil, talking about the fact that all of us in the context like the diaspora case America, you know, there's some sense of kind of shock and confusion and consternation about, gee, this isn't the narrative that our rabbis gave us, the communal professionals gave us, which I, you know, clearly historically is true. I mean, we all have our experience from, you know, growing up in these communities like Baltimore, Boston, whatever. Rabbis who literally talked about Israel every Shabbos morning.
Right, right.
Never talked about
I had one of those, yeah.
So when this stuff started coming out in the 80s, it was really shocking to people. But you have to assume, I mean, Israelis, they knew this.
Right.
These were people who came back from these campaigns. They knew what had happened. So, you know, and that's something that I think people always feel very strongly when they go to Israel, which is, there you walk down the street and people are arguing about everything. Here, where there's much more of a sense of, oh, we can't talk about this or that, it's
right,
too scary, it's too threatening. Israel, they talk about it because the point is they've lived through all this stuff.
Absolutely.
So, you know, he in that sense is both, you know, doing the historian thing, but he's also doing the Israeli thing. He's just sort of reminding people that, and Shavit too, I think. The reason why Shavit comes at the end of that chapter on Lita to say, look, yeah, sure, it was terrible. The bombing of Dresden was terrible. The firebombing
right,
of Tokyo was terrible. It doesn't invalidate the war aims. People understand once you have war, bad things are going to happen, and on a moral plane, you got to deal with that. But it's not like Shavit fundamentally is saying, oh yes, and therefore I sort of reinterrogate the question of the war aims, because the goal of the war was to birth the state.
Right on, and one of the goals of this course is to show you that Israel is an endless onion. Keep peeling away the layers, and it gets more and more complicated. When I led a birthright trip a number of years ago, because I wanted to see what it was like, and one of the kids came to me and said, you know, how come everybody keeps saying it's complicated? Because the truth is, you can't just teach Israel to 20-year-olds in particular in 10 days. It's very imperfect. But the effort, which I hope you get out of this course too, has been a supreme one. Right? It is remarkable in history and it needs to be improved because there's been some pretty bad missteps along the way. But remember those slides I showed last week about Tel Aviv in 1909, the sand dunes in Tel Aviv in 2012, the skyscrapers? Really amazing things have been done. This is one of the big issues that's not being ignored. It's being dealt with slowly, painfully, but it's out there. It's out there. Would anybody like to, yeah?
Can I give you two observations? Number one, one of the problems with this, quote, unquote, problems, is that our not-so-nice enemies throw it back at us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an ethical, moral basis for saying that the Israel was born in sin, if you will. Okay?
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that this is so hard to deal with in terms of the American Jewish community. The other observation is, this is what the Bible was all about. When the Israelites came into Canaan, this is what they were doing.
Well, the Torah, unfortunately, tells us of a genocide of the Amalekites.
Oh, that's what I'm saying.
Right. So, that's, you know, whose rabbi gave a sermon on genocide in the Amalekites? You know, they don't do that. Do they, David?
Depends what shul you go to.
Yeah, that's right. I've been in shuls in Israel, they do, and I might not like the results of that sermon. Yeah, right. So, this stuff happened. It's a good thing to start talking about it. Does anybody want to react to this before I move on? Because I hate to kind of just drop this.
Okay.
And yeah.
You go ahead.
I'm just going to say, I think some of this is our particular neuroses as Americans, that everything in the world is a win-win, that everything can be reconciled, and everybody's
right, neatly packaged,
can be accommodated, because you know we don't forget that there was an entire population in... that lived in this hemisphere that we decimated to create great cities and buildings and civilizations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we destroyed to create.
Yeah, every great civilization literally destroyed another civilization. You're absolutely correct. Yeah.
All I was going to say is that recently there was all this controversy in Washington, D.C. at the JCC about the admission. And this is a play that deals with exactly this issue. The horror and the reactionary response of the Jewish community there in 2014, because they don't want to think and talk and examine this, shows how resistant that we are as a people to the underbelly of our development.
Well, I mean, Jews are highly introspective. The people who have no introspection whatsoever are Arabs.
Well, there are many Arabs who do have introspection. Let's not cast aspersion on entire people.
Just like
we know our culture well. I can't speak for the Arab culture.
I just want to say as the end of this, if anybody wants to see a remarkable play, Mark and I went into D.C. to see what all this controversy was about, and we went to see it, and the JCC people were pulling out funding and leaving the board over this play that was looking at what happened to this village near Haifa.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a father who had fought there, and then the son who had been injured in the army today, and how they were just reconciling their narratives and their relationship with the Palestinian, the Israeli Arabs that are still in the community. But it was a very interesting and sensitive portrayal of what this conversation was.
Yeah, and
just to be clear, the Federation, I work for the Washington Federation, we back the JCC 100% in terms of putting it on. So we didn't, there was no funding pulled out. There may have been individuals.
Well, there were threats.
There were individuals who were upset and they threatened to pull their funding from the Federation, but
okay, so
couldn't be a
play. Let me let Marshall two more and then I'm going to move on.
But you're going to, part of this is the big sore, which is the the camps where the refugees are.
Right, it's what happened since then makes it worse.
And what happened, why, like most refugee groups, they haven't dispersed to
Where they haven't been integrated, right.
And why it's been left that way, whether that's a plan, you know, some people say it was a plan by the Arab countries, et cetera. But that's one of the things that keeps precipitating this kind of thing, because they're there.
Right.
They're there, and they want to come back, they want their reparations, et cetera.
And I promise you we will give time and space for more of this in the weeks to come.
I just want to say, I think it's great to have a source of information, and for me to participate in the learning and to find out and not be afraid of what you're going to find out, not necessarily to interpret everything, you know, and finalize your ideas, but to go through the exercise of knowing the history, not just of our own people, but of what is happening out in the world. And I think you refer to the U.S. and what the problems are. I mean, you know, we get into these situations where we just don't know enough of the history and, you know, all the details that are involved and the nuances to the issues. So, you know, people are going to come out to different conclusions, but it's good to get the information out.
And that's why we're here. That's why we're here, is to deepen our knowledge base so we can have the conversation. Because in Judaism and for the Jewish people, it's about the conversation, at least for me. So one of the things that we need to talk about, too, is the Jewish refugee crisis. There were pogroms that took place in Jewish communities in various countries during this time and right after this time. This set off a wave of immigration of Jews from Arab lands, as well as Iran, to the state of Israel, and we're going to talk more about that in the weeks to come as well. It wasn't quite an equal exchange. There was probably about 650,000 Jews from Arab lands. I'll get you more specific numbers on that when we look at it. But we talked a little earlier about there was a massive exchange of populations. It wasn't planned in any fashion whatsoever. It wasn't quid pro quo. But I just want you to know that there was tremendous upheaval caused by the creation of the state of Israel. And this is one of the results of it. And Aleppo, by the way, which was a beautiful ancient city until the recent war. I don't know if any of you have seen pictures of the marketplace before and after. It's so tragic. I've always wanted to go there. They had an ancient Jewish community. Most of the Syrian Jews left in 94. There was a secret thing negotiated between the State Department, Syria, and Israel. There were about 4,000 Jews in Syria. Last I had heard, there were 300, 400 Jews in Syria. That was before the war. I don't know how many are there now.
Isn't that where the Codex was?
Yeah, and that's a great, there's a great book that came out about that. Amoti Friedman wrote it. It was really neat. The war was costly. Israel lost about 1% of its population. That would be the equivalent of the United States losing about 3.2 million people. 3.2 million people. Very, very costly, particularly for a state which is in such throes. These are estimates for the Arabs. The estimates are all over the place. This again gets into the problem of not knowing Arab sources and having them be held secret. I've seen estimates as high as 10,000, 15,000. I got this from a Mideast annual yearbook from a number of years ago, and so that's the only place I can really source it, which is why I went with those numbers. So I'm not going to tell you those are verifiable sources. Those are verifiable numbers, but that's what I could find. Acharon Acharon Chaviv, finally, 10 major results of the war. State of Israel's existence seems secure for now. Israel's going to have some problems with cross-border raids in the 50s. That's where we're going to meet a guy named Ariel Sharon. Israel's going to launch a war in 56, but it does it not because it feels existentially threatened, although you can make the argument with the shipping from the Gulf. Israel really isn't existentially threatened again until 67 in terms of an actual military alliance against it. Significant expansion of territory. Really significant expansion of territory. Combat experience nearly for everyone other than the elderly, the Haredim, and of course the Arabs who stayed, I should add. Israel Defense Forces is created and now has proper armaments. And again, we're going to send this out, hopefully tonight, email it, if not tomorrow morning. Government authority is cemented. No separate militias. That's a big deal. Cementing authority is a big deal. This country faced the same thing. Remember the state militias? Irgun is disbanded and becomes a political party. First it becomes Chirut, which means freedom or liberation. Then it comes Gahal, it joins with a group called the General Zionists. And then in 73 and 74, a new politician named Ariel Sharon, there he is again, helps Menachem Begin form the Likud. Sharon's the guy that goes around to all parties and says, join the Likud. Refugees created. Arabs within Israel are going to be under military rule until 1966. You need permission to leave your village. You need permission to leave your village. Country is about 80% Jewish. Beyond the Zionist wildest dreams. Beyond the Zionist wildest dreams. Jews pour in from Europe, Holocaust survivors, and Arab lands. Starts when the war is still going on, particularly in the last phase. But in that last phase, we see that there is going to be a state, that they are going to win, so people start emigrating. People start emigrating, and the state starts bringing them in as well. We've covered a lot tonight. We even covered some sensitive stuff. Are there any questions? All right, keep on reading. I know it's a lot of stuff, but it's good stuff. All right, I hope you guys are enjoying the new chapters of the Shapiro book, if you had a chance to read that. The documents book is wonderful, too. If you had a chance, by the way, the Ben-Gurion excerpt that's in the documents book about the war, you should know that what Ben-Gurion was always doing is you would come into his office and he was sitting down and he was writing. He was always writing in his diary. And you would talk to him and he'd keep on writing. And he'd just keep writing this stuff and he'd keep writing this stuff. And he's got volumes and volumes and volumes. He was a man acutely aware of history and his role in it. All right, well, that's my story and I'm sticking with it. Thank you. Have a good night.